And immediately we connected. At least I felt we did. Steve may disagree, but I felt like we were brothers of another mother. In that we thought so much alike. As I explained to someone earlier, he had been involved in a Calvary chapel and had left. I had been involved, of course, and was picked up. Steve has been working all this time in Thailand, in refugee camps, and he has been ministering to the spiritual needs and the physical needs of refugees from Myanmar. These are people, ethnic groups, who have been treated severely. Many atrocities have taken place. Some of them have escaped. The only surviving member of their family, or one of few surviving members of an entire village. Some coming without limbs, and all of them coming with trauma and horror stories. Among the Karen refugees, there's a large population of Christians. And historically, the majority per capita of Christians in all of Asian nations have been the Karen people. And the story of how they came to faith in Jesus is a fascinating one, because God prepped their culture for them to be ready to respond as soon as they heard the gospel. Anyway, no more introduction. I'm going to introduce you now to Steve Kumar. Thank you a lot for being here, Steve.
In August of 2017, I traveled to northern Iraq and then was driven across the border into Syria by a young Kurdish Syrian guy named Bashir. And my trip, the reason that we were going is because we've been trying to get into Syria for 2 years. So far, the only one that has gotten in legally is my wife, because she has a Norwegian passport, and because we know a couple of powerful people. It's kind of like doing business with the devil, actually, to go into Syria legally. So I went illegally, and I was taken across the desert, and we went to a place just outside of Raqqa. Is my mic working? So, do you guys know about Raqqa? It's the last big stronghold of ISIS in the Middle East. So, we drove to Raqqa and Kobani and Qamishli, all of the major cities in Kurdish Syria. And our purpose for being there was to find ways to get involved with their children and to get involved with people who, because of violence and political complexity, are not getting the help that they could otherwise get from the international community. So I went there, and this young man introduced me to the Raqqa Civic Council and the people who were governing this crisis. They were mostly military guys, but they had a civilian branch. Interestingly, our special forces were there. In fact, they'll be there now permanently Tillerson extended it by 2 years. Do you guys know what's happening in Syria and Turkey? And, you know, one of our most important NATO allies is now bombing us because we're supporting the Kurds, who they don't want to have the kind of clout or power that the U.S. Special Forces gives them. Have you guys watched that at all? Do you see that on the news here? So I was in Raqqa, and I met the Raqqa Civic Council and asked them. I said, we are a small Christian organization, and our budgets are small, but we accept the risk that is part of the deal if you're going to work in a place like this, and we'd like to help you. So we asked, how can we help? And almost without exception, the first thing that they said was, we need help with trauma care, which interests you, Chuck, because They said we have tens of thousands of orphans, tens of thousands of children who have either directly experienced or witnessed terrible ISIS violence. And these kids are malfunctioning and they need help. They had the presence of mind and even the education to identify this as PTSD. And so they asked if we knew any trauma counselors who could come and train their leaders and their teachers to care for these kids. And so I know of one. His name's Glenn. This is him. Can you stand up, Glenn? Glenn's been working with us for 15 years, practicing trauma therapy and now training small teams, especially of women, to help other women who have been the victims of sexual violence or other forms of extreme violence. I'm deeply grateful for Glenn, and Glenn and my wife are trying to put together a trip right now to go into the area of Raqqa that I've mentioned. So they said, we need help with our kids. And these are, wow, I could go on a big rabbit trail about how wonderful these people are. Do you know about the Kurds? It's the biggest ethnic group on the planet without a country. There's 65 million Kurds. And their land was divided by French and British and actually all of the colonial powers. And their land was divided so that some million of them ended up in northern Iraq. 5 to 7 million ended up in what is now Syria. And then some bunches of million ended up in what is Turkey. And then there's some in Iran. And then the diaspora, they're all over the world. No country. These wonderful people. And the ones that I was working with were ideological communists, which was also fascinating for me, just because of the time I grew up. And to talk to government workers who say that there is no mother or father, there's only the state. There is no lover or wife or husband, there's only the service of our country. This was like communism before it tips over. You know what I mean? It was in a way beautiful because they were so committed to rebuilding a country and an existence that had been flattened. And by flattened, here's what I mean. When ISIS occupied Syria and Iraq and anywhere that they've been, when they leave, they don't just leave bullet holes and booby traps. They detonate every load-bearing wall on every public building. So those buildings are flattened like concrete and rebar pancakes. Boom, 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 boom. The city of Kobani, this city that I've mentioned already a couple times, it's a city of over 1 million people, and 80% of the buildings are flattened. So these are people, really strong people. By the way, it was like between 130 and 140 degrees the whole time I was there. So it's the Nineveh Desert, right? And these people are tough. And not only that, they come out of the rubble of what their homes are, so to say, and make tea and put their last sugar in it and offer it to you. They're amazing people. So I'm visiting these people, and they say, yeah, can you take over these refugee camps? Can you take over this feeding program? Our medical facilities are destroyed. There are no hospitals. There's one Doctors Without Border clinic for 5 million people, and so forth. So the needs were intense. And driving through the desert, it's a barren desert I had to drive through for about 5 hours to get to where these cities are. But then I got to the Euphrates River, that big, you know, biblical river, and the Tigris River in northern Iraq. And I got there, and what you find in the desert, walking through the desert, are families with 7 little kids. And they're carrying what they have, they're wearing what they have, they're all tattered, they're all beat up. It's 140 degrees in the desert. They don't have food, they don't know where they're going, and they don't know what's next. I don't mean just a few, I mean it's tens of thousands of people in that condition. That was what we drove into. And it's because of ISIS and the destruction that they've left behind. But you know what? It's not just ISIS. Everyone I interviewed got shot up by Assad. Then the Free Syrian Army showed up and broke my leg and raped my daughter. Then I ended up with one of the other 40 other militias that are armed in Syria in this failed state. Did you know the country of Syria a few years ago had 15 million people and was called the safest country in the Middle East? Did you know that? Now, half of the population is gone. 7.5 million people are gone. 7.5 million remain, and of those 7.5 million that remain, a large percentage of those people are living an existence. It's called internal displacement. These are people who are just wandering around trying to avoid contact with somebody with a gun and keep their kids alive. That's it. Internally displaced. Pretty bleak, right? It's like a Cormac McCarthy book, The Road or something. It's just outrageous destruction of beauty and life. So, driving through the desert, meet these people, and they say, our kids are traumatized. So I said, well, we have two trauma therapy guys, two early childhood development experts, and we want to get involved. And furthermore, we've got this amount of budget. We can do some other stuff. So we said, take us to meet some of these children. Show us these schools that have been flattened. They asked for help starting their schools again. So this guy got in the car with me. He's got a PhD from Cairo University. Intellect on fire. Read everything I've read. Spiritual, everything. Just amazing young guy with three little kids. Passionate about education. Part of this communist ideology, which they don't have wives or kids, so I don't know how he pulled that off, but he had three kids. But so we drove with him and we looked at schools. And again, the schools are flat. They're pancaked on the ground. And I was going to walk into one of these schools and take pictures in the rubble from a different position. And as soon as I stepped across the threshold of the gate, he grabbed me and said, no, you can't go into this school. We walked into a couple of schools, school areas, but we couldn't go into that one. And I said, why? It's just rubble. There's nothing in there. And he said, our guys haven't cleared it yet, so it's landmined. They landmine the rubble of schools because they know that the value of these people is to get their kids back in school, so they're going to go try and, you know, rebuild this thing or clean it up. 3 weeks later, I was in Southern California. I flew from Syria. I got back to Northern Iraq, flew to Southern California, and I heard that that guy going into a school that he thought was cleared, he stepped on a landmine and died. It was 3 weeks later. Really brought it home for me, you know? Like, when they say don't walk there, you don't walk there. It's no man's land. And it's no man's land for not tens of thousands, millions of people who are on the wrong end of a rifle, on the wrong end of a black boot, and really at the end of the road when it comes to life. And for me, it was heartbreaking to meet them and to see them and drive past them. What can I do? What are you going to do? I sat with this family of, they were like seven people, and this guy is one of those guys, shot up by Assad, moved north, Free Syrian Army tortured him. He ended up in another city on the Euphrates River where this big dam is that ISIS blew up, and an airstrike from Turkey blew the crap out of him. Then he was scrounging for tin cans to recycle them. I mean, this is a real story. I'm recounting a real story of this guy I just sat with. When I met him, his family were living under garbage. They had pieced together cloth and garbage to keep the sun off of them. They were close enough to the Euphrates River so they could get water. The water's polluted, though, so they're sick. It's a sad place, right? And so so I said, can we meet some of the kids? It's traumatized kids. Back to the kids. I work for an organization called Partners Relief and Development. And our vision is freedom and fullness for children affected by war. Where large agencies won't go is where we target, because it's there that there is the most intense denial of justice to the most vulnerable people on the planet. That's where we want to go. And like you said, Chuck, we got started in Myanmar and stayed there for 24 years now. But 2 years ago, we got involved in Iraq and Syria and now Yemen for the same reason. So we were driven by this lady to meet some children who had suffered ISIS violence in order to have a more personal connection to the story that we were getting involved in here. And I walked through a doorway of a standing structure. It was a square concrete block structure. And there was a concrete pad that we sat on in the sizzling sun. And as we walked in, there were four of us. We walked in, and there's an 84-year-old grandmother about from here to from me to you. And she started crying and throwing her arms around and shouting at me. And I immediately felt uncomfortable, and I asked my translator what she's saying. And he said, she's saying, what good is it to tell my story to another white guy? It's not going to bring my loved ones back, and it hurts. And when they leave, my grandchildren are still going to be hungry. You know, I realized she had met journalists. Did you know journalists can't help people? Did you know that? It's not that they're cold, callous individuals. It's the ethics of journalism. If you help them, you're manipulating what could be the story that you're going to get. So they had met these journalists who told them these unbelievable stories of violence and survival, and then the journalists just leave. And so I had a camera around my neck, unfortunately. I took it off, put it in my backpack. I took my black notebook down, put it away. And I said, Grandma, I'm not a journalist. I'm just a man. I work with a small organization, Christian organization, mostly Christians. And we've asked your government how we can help you and help the children. They've told us that the children in Kobani, that's where we were then, now, right outside of Raqqa, are traumatized, and there's been these massacres, and there's thousands of orphans and thousands of traumatized kids, and we want to find ways to help. So we only wanted to meet you, and really, if having met you now, if you would allow me to pray for you, I'll leave. You don't have to tell me anything. You don't have to tell me your story. I'm just grateful to meet you. And so the grandma stared down at this concrete slab and reflected, and then pointed at her nose. And she said, you see my nose, right? And I said, yeah, I see your nose. She said, when ISIS came, they shot me in the face. Her nose was mostly scar tissue. And then they shot me here, and she lifted her skirt to show me a bullet wound on her hip. And she said, and then I passed out, which is probably why I'm still alive. But before I passed out, they brutally murdered my son and daughter in front of me and in front of their children, my grandchildren. And then I passed out. After I passed out, they went to my three grandchildren. They were age 9, 3, and 6 years old. Girl, boy, girl. And first they went to my oldest granddaughter and brutally, I don't want to say what they did because there's kids here. So just treated her really badly. And then they didn't do anything to the boy. And then the 9-month-old, you can't even imagine what they did. It's just disgusting. But she survived. And she's left with a permanent disability because her hip's all cut up. But she survived. And she was sitting from me to you. She was that close to me. Beautiful, beautiful child. Beautiful children. And so the grandma told me this whole story. It was more than I mean, she just opened up and decided that I was safe, and she talked to me. And I told her that I'm terribly sorry. I can't imagine going through that kind of grief. And I promised her that I would do everything I could for her and her family, but more so for all of the families surrounding where we were sitting that day, who are in the same situation as them. So I prayed for Grandma and asked Jesus to be a firm part of her story. And then I gave her $200, the equivalent of that, which was a pretty good sum of money. We don't usually give cash to people like that. It's, first of all, it's unfair. And if word gets out, it can turn into the zombie apocalypse really fast. But it's also not the best way to help people. But in this case, 84-year-old grandma with these grandchildren falling through the cracks, yeah, I'll give you my money. Everything I got, it's yours. So I gave her my money and gave her my hugs. We hugged her. And then I told her that we would work to do things long-term to make something beautiful come out of this grief. Something beautiful happen despite the fact that she's suffered the way she has. And last week we opened our second school in Kobani. Is that good news? Last week we also did a distribution for 1,300 and something widows. We rounded up all the widows who were walking around in the desert. Every community wants their widow helped. And we rounded up all the ones we could find in the immediate area around Raqqa and gave them a month's supply of food so that they and their children don't starve. Because not only, you know, it's bad enough to be a family with your husband or the man with you, but imagine being just a mom or a woman with 4, 5, 6 kids. How do they make it? I don't know how they make it. The good news in this traumatizing story is that we were there. And in my opinion, that is exactly what the gospel is. It's about showing up. You know, I used to think it was about propositional truth, the invitations to give your life to Jesus and change your way of thinking, as Bob Dylan said. Get a different set of rules. That's what he said. No. The gospel is about showing up. And when it's little kids, you show up and you get on the floor with them and you become a part of their story and you be Jesus. You step into the shoes of the guy that we worship. And what I found is you don't have to go far to be that guy. It's in this room. It's in our towns. No matter where we go. He needs to show up, and the only way it happens is when he shows up in us. You guys hear me? And this is what I've experienced with Chuck. It's one of the reasons I'm a repeat offender with all his church projects. Oh, I'm sorry, it's not a church. And he's not a pastor. Well, we're all on this path to try and figure it out. And all of us gets it wrong. That's just a given. That's part of the deal. And then we're trying to correct course, and we need to find people that we can do life with and love and be accepted by, right? And that's what I see happen. He's just, what's that psychological word? He's obsessive about community, right? And I love that. It's really what I'm about. It's what my team is about. We're Partners Relief and Development is 60 people working full-time doing 3 things. Sustainable community development, strengthening families and social structures, schools. And the third thing is relief for acute crisis when people are starving and just need that hand up to make it through the crisis. So we do these 3 things, and we do them in war zones. And we do them on your back. It's your broad shoulders that get us there. There's a number of people in this room who financially support us. So I'm deeply grateful for that. And when I meet children like I met in August, those 3 kids, those are 3 of thousands that I met in those 12 days in Syria, I'm reminded in a powerful way why I do what I do. My vision for the future is kids that go to bed knowing they're going to wake up safe in the loving nurture of their family knowing that they're going to have shelter over their heads. My vision for the future is kids everywhere having two meals a day and not being protein malnourished and not going without the things that they need to be all of the potential that God meant for them to be to the world. So this whole thing about community has been an intriguing part of our friendship, Chuck, and Glenn, too. After all these years, are there a lot of you that have been around with Chuck for 15, 20 years?
I'm only getting long hair.
Now he doesn't have any. It does. Shoot, it's happening to me, I found out. So, to me, the single most valuable thing about life is these relationships we have. I mean, if we don't have somebody that we can really share with and be honest with, somebody who's not judgy, somebody who's not, condescending or sort of like paternalistic, these friendships where you're doing life together and you're learning from one another and there's no higher or lower, do you get the vibe that that's who you got here? Because that's kind of how I have always felt with Chuck. And that's how I feel with Glenn. So there's another guy. I'm gonna talk for a few more minutes about the Bible, if I may. But before that, I'd like to introduce you to my young friend, Anders. He's joined our team for an internship, and he's become part of our community. And the reason I'm highlighting this is because he's in, you know? And I hope he stays in for a long time. And you'll see when he stands up, he's got a ton to offer. But you'll see, some of you, because you've been around the block, you see this young guy, he's unmarried, talented at everything, good looking, thinks he's immortal, right? Okay, and you know life's going to crush him. We all know that, right? Do we know that? You know, I want to cuss. It's going to kill him, just like it kills us all. And the way we get through it is one another. One another believing that God is a part of the equation and we support one another. Right? So let me introduce my friend. He's going to do a song for us. Because I know you're bored of me. His name's Anders.
My vision, be my
So the Bible is an interesting book because you can read it over and over again and completely miss the plot. I am really capable at that art. My first 2 years as a Christian, I kept track of how many times I read the scripture. I read it 7 times, cover to cover, in 2 years. And somewhere, probably about the third reading, it became about being better than you and not about knowing what it said. But anyhow, I read it 7 times, cover to cover, and I committed big parts of it to memory. Like, I knew the first 3 chapters of Romans, word for word, and I had memorized all of those important verses by which you invite someone to a new belief system, you know, the Roman road. You really were supposed to laugh at that, because it I don't know how it works. I really don't. I don't know why I and probably all of us go down this road of just assuming we know what it means, but never really getting it. I don't know how that happened. You know, when I gave my life to Christ and burned all my LSD and my cocaine and my, you know, all my former life stuff when I turned it, just before I turned 18, I really wanted God I wanted him with my whole heart. I wanted everything he had. Right? Can you can identify with that, right? You, wherever the heck you are, show up in my bedroom tonight, because I need you. You know, and have any of you played around with just saying, I don't believe in him anymore? It's because I have. It's such a burden to bear sometimes, and there's so much bullshit in the culture that you can't make sense of it. It would be easier to just walk away. Okay, I'm an atheist now. Leave me alone. I don't want any of it. But you know what that is? That's worse. I can't make it. I can't make it without Jesus. I'm just weak. I'm a weak guy. I can't lean into reality without this figure. And I've read the Bhagavad Gita, and I've read the Buddhist scriptures, and I read all the Hindu stuff. I read everything looking for him. And I found him in the Bible. This is how I discovered God. And I just can't walk away from it. It's too beautiful and too great. And when I go back at it with a whole new lens, you know, the first time I reread it, I was looking for Rose. Rose was this widow that got raped and tortured for 9 months and took in this first orphan child and asked my wife and I to support her $30 a year to care for this first little girl. That's how we got started. This is 1994, October 1994. Well, when I met Rose and I met malnourished kids, you know, kids whose head is 13 years old but their body's 8, have you seen that? And then they got the distended tummies because they're full of parasites, because their water's not clean and their life's a wreck, and they die from preventable illnesses all the time. I met all that and I said, where are they in my story? That's why I read the Bible again. I said, where are these people? And what blew my mind is I ran into them right away. I like to start the story that I discovered in Deuteronomy. It's just powerful how, you know, Moses gets this tribal mandate, crowd control mandate, the Ten Commandments, the thing to keep us in the club, right? The summary of the mandate, those Ten Commandments, is Deuteronomy 6:5. And that summary says, you'll love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. The proof that you love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength is the Ten Commandments. That's the proof. And that shines right up to the New Testament, where when Jesus asked, how do you go to heaven? He says, love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. He quotes it. And then he quotes a weird verse. If you look at it in context, super weird. Leviticus 19:18 says, you'll love your neighbor as yourself. There are 1,000 other places that occurs. Why does he choose that one? Okay, so listen to this. I'm reading through the Old Testament. I'm looking for the widow, Rose. I'm looking for the orphan, all these children I'm meeting. I'm looking for the poor, these refugees, and the refugees. And I come to Deuteronomy chapter 24. Now, it has been said over and over again already. But here's Deuteronomy 24 is where it's said with loudspeakers. It says, you will do the following things because you need to remember where you came from. You were once slaves in a foreign land. I set you free. So you will do the following things. And here's what they have to do. Farmers, you have to leave the edges and the corners of your field because it belongs to the poor. Not just any old poor, the quartet of the vulnerable, Nicholas Wolterstorff, Calvin guy that I like to read, says, the widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor. That's who owns the edges of your field. And then he says to olive growers, you can harvest your olives. It's the fruit of your labor. You get the first pass. Those olives that are either overripe or unripe and you leave them, those aren't yours. Those belong to the widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor. And then he says to the grape growers, you get the first pass. All of those grapes are yours. You've worked hard for that. But not the second pass. That doesn't belong to you. That's for the widow and the alien and the orphan and the poor. And what you'll find throughout Deuteronomy before and after that stereophonic chapter 24, what you'll find is the widow, alien, orphan, and the poor being talked about a lot. Basically, if they are not helped and nurtured, God will open a fiery hole and swallow you. If they're not nurtured, if justice, biblical justice, is not done, that's restorative justice, not penal justice. If biblical justice isn't served out in the life of those, then I don't like you. It's over and over again. That's what God says. And it's a narrative I never saw before, Chuck. And I don't know how I missed it, really. So then, skip ahead to the prophets. I always thought that the prophets were about leaders, the aristocracy or other leaders in the Hebrew tribe going after other gods, worshiping the fertility poles up on the high places. They get involved with, you know, a concubine, and they go up there and do their stuff and worship other gods, and God sends lightning down and thrashes them, or sends Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Isaiah, right? Have you guys understood the major prophets like that? You know, they're unfaithful, and so they get called back so they don't have to go into captivity again or rolled over by a war machine. Well, when I read it looking for the widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor, guess what I found? The widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor. And over again, the anger of the prophets is leveled at the Hebrew aristocracy for using their privilege and oppressing the poor, for being wealthy on the backs of the poor while the poor pull a double shift. The poor call in sick and they lose their job. The wealthy stay at home and finish that last jug of wine, right? So, and if you don't believe me, read Ezekiel or Jeremiah and ask yourself, where do the poor fit into this narrative? Ask yourself that when you read it. And the grand slam book is Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 1 comes right out of the gate begging God to be a voice for the voiceless and God begging us to be a voice for the voiceless. And from Isaiah chapter 1 to the very end, what you have is the prophet talking about justice and righteousness. Those are the same word in the Old Testament. There are acts of justice, and then there is a state of justice. These are two Hebrew words. Righteousness actually isn't even used. When you see the word righteous, all that means is a state of justice. And it's social justice, by the way, contrary to Fox News. So what you have here, that was getting out of my lane. I'm really sorry. So I read Isaiah. And I came to Isaiah 58, and by the time I got to Isaiah chapter 58, I was ashamed of myself. Because what I thought the prophets were all about isn't what they're about at all. And I came to Isaiah 58, and it's such a powerful summary of the prophet, the prophetic message, that I've just got to share it with you. I used to think it was like the one who fasts. This is the one that says, is this not the fast that I have chosen, right? You all know this passage, right? This is like on, you know, stuff you buy at the Christian bookstore on a painting. The fast that I have chosen. And I believed and was taught that if I fast, according to that passage and others, I will break spiritual bonds of iniquity. I will set the captives free. God will hear me, and it will be like food for the poor. That's really what I thought Isaiah 58 said. Do you guys know Isaiah 58? I probably should have read it. Okay? I'm not going to read it, though, because it's kind of... Yeah, pull it up, Anders. Great. That's why you joined her. So Isaiah 58, you have to understand the context. And I'm thankful to Rob Bell for helping me understand the context of this. But here's the context. The Hebrew tribe is enjoying a relative period of peace between absolute chaos and war and captivity again. They're enjoying this period of peace. And the leaders, the aristocrats of this tribe, decided that they're going to build a temple to the God that freed them from slavery. Right? And so they're building this temple, but guess who's building the temple to the God who set people free from slavery? You're allowed to drop the F-bomb on that. They're using slaves to build a temple to the God who set them free from slavery. And you have to understand that, or else you don't get the anger and the passion and even the context of Isaiah 58. He's not saying, this is the fasting I prescribe. He's saying, oh great, you're fasting again. What he's saying is true religion, like James says in 1 verse 27, true religion is caring for the widows and orphans in time of distress. What Isaiah is saying is, yeah, you use your fasting to oppress the poor. They go to work and pull a double shift and their kid has tuberculosis and he dies at home and you still make them work. They work for a month and you don't pay them because they showed up late that day. Shame on you, says God. You want your light to break out like the noonday sun? That's an exact quote. You better help the widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor. There's no other track. That's it. If you want to go to heaven, you got to do for others what you would want done for you. There's no other track. If you want a one sentence description of Christian faith, it's love God and love your neighbor. Oh, back to Leviticus. Remember I said it's a weird place to quote? Why did Jesus use that one? Well, Leviticus has all the hair rules, you know, hairy tumor, unhairy tumor, black hair, white hair. Then you got all the food rules, cloven hoofed and upright walker and bottom sniffer and whatever, all these weird rules, right? And you read that and you're thinking, okay, they want him to be, they want these people to be different, clearly. But the summary statement of all that weirdness, and it's repeated in Leviticus 2, is that you will do for your neighbor what you would want done for you. The superseding law of the Hebrew tribe, the top shelf law, is love God and love neighbor. Everything else is extra. Everything else is the in-between. You guys follow that? So then Jesus, let's go back to Jesus. He announces himself as the man, right? Luke chapter 4, first time he's speaking in public. First time he opens his mouth in public. And he's accepted his mission. He stands up on stage, pulls out two scrolls, at least one and another part of another one, because it's two chapters. He quotes from Isaiah 61 and Isaiah 58. Isaiah 61, of course, is here's the Lord's anointed, right? And that's me. Okay, but Isaiah 58? Why did he choose that? Of all the things he could have used to announce his mission on earth, why did he choose Isaiah 58? Do you think he knew the significance of that chapter? And when I read it, I was like, it's Isaiah 58. That's the mission of Jesus. That's the white-hot core of our faith. And that's the life of Christ. Suddenly, I can understand Matthew 20. I could never understand it before. You know the sheep and the goats? The goats go to hell because they don't visit people in prison. I was always like, what? That's not pray after me. You know, give your life to Jesus stuff. I always saw it as anecdotal extras. Maybe it snuck into the canon. Maybe King James 35 men had a bad night and got a little too drunk. I don't know. But what I know is I never could make sense of Matthew 20 being a part of the body of Jesus, the message of Jesus. And I could never understand the book of James. And then, now listen to this. Here's the last one. I'm about to quit. Sorry, because I think it's important. That's one reason. I think if we're going to follow Jesus, we need to understand what his mission is and start being nice to each other. You know, and let people live, right? Okay, but also it's like all of us, I know in this room and every room, God, or something new about following him, right? I mean, Chuck couldn't have gotten away with the gong at one of his old churches. You got something new, right? And it brings something out that wasn't there before. And so we're all living into this story. We're living into the truth of who God is, trying to make it something beautiful for us and for the world around us. And this narrative that I had before, it was all about me being holy and me being, you know, more anointed and me being more saved. It was driven largely by guilt. And it was nurtured in church. You know, church nurtures that. It's crowd control. How do you stay together? How do you pay the bills? You know, it's there's something sideways about it, right? Okay, so I can be super honest about this here. Yes. But you say anything anywhere else, you're dead. Okay, so I read 1 John. And I had taught Calvary Chapel style, verse by verse, through the book of 1 John. I used MacArthur's commentary on it, which, you know, it was, of course, the best. I taught verse by verse, and this is, I could tell you, I could go through the whole thing right now, because I loved that book. It's John combating the Gnostic heresy. The Gnostic heresy is the idea that you could sin in the flesh and stay holy in the spirit. That the flesh and the spirit were not connected. And John spends time laboring against this heresy, bringing together your spirituality and your physical experience. What you do in your body matters. What you do with your body matters. What you do with your spirit matters. It's all integrated. Well, what I realized when I read 1 John again is it's the greatest commandment with a skip in the vinyl. That's all it is. Love God with your whole heart. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself, then they know you love God. Love God, love your neighbor. Love God, love your neighbor. Over and over and over again. If you want to know what love looks like, it looks like me loving Chuck when he's depressed. If you want to know what love looks like, it looks like me helping Glenn when he's a complete loser. Both bad examples, but back to 1 John, it says over and over again, we know love. Because we love others. We know love because God in us, and when God is in us, we love others. Chapter 3, verse 16 through 18 is where I really got hit. And this is an extremely annoying passage. Here's what it says. We know love because Jesus loved us and laid his life down for us, and we also ought to do that too. I was like, is that how you get saved? You know, I thought it was about getting saved. It's not. The getting saved is, that's the rest of our lives. We're all on this path. We're all trying to figure it out. We're all moving there. We're all on a scale of 1 to 10, everyone on earth. Right? God is in pursuit of everyone on earth. And when you take away these abusive categories of lost and found, suddenly people are amazingly fun to hang out with. And you can relax and you don't have to protect your boundaries. And then you can really actually start learning. So I read this. True love is Jesus who laid his life down for us. We also ought to lay our lives down for others. So then it says this. Who of you, if you see someone in material need and you close your heart against them, how can you say God's love is in you? Some translations say, if you see the poor and do not help them, how can you say God's love is in you? I like the translation of a closed heart better because it's not always the best thing to give poor people, you know, a homeless guy, you shouldn't put him in an apartment. That's not what they need, you know, and sometimes the best thing to do is not to give money. I like this thing of your heart has to stay open. Who of us, if we sees material poverty and is not moved with compassion, how can we say God's love is in us? That's a rhetorical question asked by John, Jesus' very best friend on earth. You got it?
Yeah.
Okay, and here's the closer. This is verse 17, or verse 18. It says this. Let us not love with word and tongue, but action and deed. Right? And so, when I look at the amazing story of the Bible and how it has slurped Steve Gamer into it, me and my wife and my three daughters, we've been slurped into this adventure. I see the refugees part of the story. They're in there. The widow, the alien, and the orphan, and the poor, those most vulnerable people in your society and mine, wherever we live, how they are treated is the measure of restorative justice that you see as the soil of this ground. That's the acid test. Our love for our neighbor is the acid test of our faith, not our proliferous, if that's a word, words. Right? And so at Partners, me and my little team. In fact, my team's about this big. At Partners, what we're trying to do is take what we've learned from Jesus, and even on my team, just like here, we're all at different stages of awareness, but we cut each other slack and we support each other. It all comes back together with community, right? So if you're an island, you're really, you know, you're drifting. There's no Lone Rangers. We all need someone to talk to. I know this for a fact. I mean, we all do, right? Yeah. I was going to make another point, but I think what I'll just do is thank you for being a part of my story and for inviting me. Does anyone here have a notebook, a lined notebook that I could rip a piece of paper out of? Because normally I come with brochures so I can get your address and your email address. I ran out. Can I just have that whole pad?
Yeah.
And do you have a pen too?
Yes,
so I'm going to just send this around starting here and pass it around and give me your email address and your mailing address. We're really careful about not hitting you up with money all the time. Our mailing list is largely to give you real understanding of the story that you can be a part of, how you can pray with us, how you in solidarity can stand with us in various ways, and then we send out a magazine twice a year, again, with the same thing in mind. We're just a story. I invite you to be a part of ours, and I hope you let me keep being a part of yours. I'm super grateful that you let me be a part of today, and thank you, and God bless you.
If you want to sign your name,
Partners Relief and Development.
Where my mind went. Last week I told you about a friend whose 31-year-old son died of cancer, and my friend's soul is crushed with grief today. And it happens in this world. And I asked myself, what was Jesus grieving? Was he grieving the pain that lay ahead of him? He was going to be tortured and crucified, the lingering suffering of his death? Was it that he was all alone in this? His disciples abandoned him? His nation was against him? Even his father forsook him? Was it the anticipation of that? And then I wondered, is it possible that it was just his human life that he was losing? And here, this context of his life, that these people, these circumstances, seeing the sights he had seen, experiencing the life that he had, and he's coming to the end of that, and you only have this one time. Even Jesus only had this one time, and it was ending. And I wonder, is that what grieved him? Because this is a normal experience when a person learns that they're dying. There's a process of grief, and it is soul-crushing. And Steve reminded us of people around the world whose circumstances are soul-crushing. And you know, I think mine are. But, you know, how wrong. I'm so incredibly wealthy compared to walking around 140-degree heat, not having enough to provide for my children. So, thank you, Steve. Thanks for shaking us up a bit and just reminding us and opening our eyes. You know, I read about the Kurds and Turkey's war against them to destroy them, and it just doesn't come home like it did today. May the Lord bless us, keep away all evil, and lead us into eternal life. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.